Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. We've got a very exciting episode today with a fantastic guest. We're joined today by Deepanita Das, co-founder and CEO of Sorcero. And today we're going to talk about improving patient outcomes through AI and NLP. For folks listening, that's artificial intelligence and natural language processing. As a fantastic update, we've got a new co-host today and someone who's helping us grow the podcast, someone who used to be or is currently, I hope, still a fan of the podcast. Maya, let you introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Maya. Yeah, I was a fan of the podcast and I'm now a co-host of the podcast. So quite an exciting pipeline for me.
Yeah. For our listeners, you're probably used to my being joined by Will, my who's the former chief strategy officer for Literal Humans. He's since moved on to an exciting new career in freelancing, and we're sad to see him go. So farewell, Will. We miss you, bud. And we'll hope to have you on in the future when you're the founder of some startup or something like that. But coincidentally, at the same time, Maya reached out and said, every podcast host wants to hear this. Like, I'm a fan of the podcast. You're maybe like the third person I've heard besides my dad to say that. So thank you for that. And Maya had some great ideas about how to improve the podcast, and I needed a new co-host, and Maya's an amazing tech journalist, and will bring a lot to the show. So we're very excited to have you on board, Maya. Thanks for joining.
Yay, I'm excited.
So back to the conversation. Deepanita, you're the co-founder and CEO of Sorcero. It sounds like your startup does a lot to kind of enhance patient outcomes using AI-powered analytics and natural language processing, and you do this to transform complex medical data into actionable insights. You were named 2024 for 40 Under 40 honoree. Congratulations. Well done on that.
Thank you.
And Sorcero was recently named number one small and mighty company by Fast Company in the world's most innovative companies list 2024. Congrats. Well done.
Thank you.
Good to have you on the pod. We're going to jump right into questions and kind of set the scene for our guests so they can learn all about improving patient outcomes through AI and NLP. Go for it, Maya.
So as I'm sure our listeners will know, generative AI is making strides and transforming every single industry, and medicine is no exception. So Dee, I'd love to ask you, what are some of the innovative ways that AI is being used and what can we expect to see in the future in medicine?
You're right that generative AI is really going to have quite a transformative effect on healthcare at large. The way we think about it is on the care delivery side and then on the manufacturing side. I think on the care delivery side, we're seeing a lot of innovation in supporting healthcare workers, nurses, and physicians in spending less time on clerical tasks or on administrative tasks, helping taking notes, telling them, keeping them updated on what the conversations with patients were, et cetera. We're also seeing a lot of innovation in sort of healthcare delivery on a D2C, so direct to consumer. There's a lot of innovations in mental health applications and so forth. But for Sorcero, we work more on the manufacturing side and in the part where an excellent therapy makes it to market. And then we support making it from bench to the patient's body more effectively. And on that side of the house, in the manufacturing, we're of course seeing some incredible progress in drug discovery. One of the biggest problems in this world and in pharma and life sciences is the absolute tsunami of data. We've been very, very focused on collecting more data from real world, from digital devices, clinical trials, literature. One of the biggest barriers to actually putting this data use is the tech. And without not just AI, but more specifically, technology that works well with large-scale, unstructured data, free-flowing text, but free-flowing text that is not just English or a particular language, but is technical. That's really where we feel that AI shines. And in being able to take these incredible LLMs and tune them to be able to work and handle this kind of content and scale is where we can drive more intelligence and analytics. So on the manufacturer side of the house, we're seeing incredible strides in drug discovery, as I mentioned, but also in operations. And when you think about the operations of a pharma company itself in commercializing one of their products, one of the most counterintuitive things is the patient is and is not the customer at the same time, because drug companies do not sell their therapies directly to patients unless they're over the counter. And most of the critical life-saving therapies are not over the counter. So that process of getting something to the right patient at the right time via a physician, via a regulator, via an insurer, That's really where we see the most transformative opportunity to bring in AI and other data science and NLP and technology to transform all of the interaction data into truly personalized communications and content so physicians and patients know precisely how to use these life-saving therapies, to whom it is most applicable, and how to access it expediently.
That's cool. And there's some really cool examples out there of AI being applied in the health sector, just to call out a few. Centara Health, improving primary care with AI-driven insights to care providers. That's really exciting. Generated Health, they created an AI nurse named Florence to assist in patient management and alleviating nursing shortages, which we've seen a lot of here in the UK. Another example is Maverick Medical AI, which built a medical coding platform to help medical providers stay on top of billing, which is actually a huge challenge, is just billing in the health space. So there's other discoveries out there: drug discovery, improving lab workflows, robotic surgery, bioinformatics. What is bioinformatics? Can you tell us, Dee, what bioinformatics is? Do you touch on that?
Sure. bioinformatics is basically statistics, in a manner of speaking, that, you know, it's related to genetics and genomics and is a scientific discipline that involves using computers to collect, store, and analyze biological data, such as a lot of the DNA data or sequences or protein sequences, etc. So biological data is very useful, but it is very specific and it is a massive, like the amount of information contained in DNA, for example, or genetics is massive. And bioinformatics is the field that works on that kind of data using technology.
Cool. Thanks for educating our audience and me on that. I appreciate that.
Not at all.
So just as a follow-up, you know, we know and we've seen that AI and NLP are rapidly advancing in the healthcare sector, and you've spoken to this, but this also comes with important ethical questions. And we're, you know, always talking about, specifically with AI, the ethics of AI. So just curious to hear from your perspective, like what the key ethical considerations are for deploying AI in life sciences specifically, and how do you at Sorcero address issues of bias in AI models, data privacy, and the potential for AI to make decisions that actually affect patient care?
That's a really great question. And it's probably something that's going to remain relevant for many, many years to come, because this is still very, very nascent. So maybe let's first start by a basic framework for what is a low, medium, and high risk application of AI itself. So something low risk could be an internal to a company subject matter expert who's accessing a suggestion made or supported by an AI system, but then is determining themselves whether to use it or not. So there is a human in the loop. And that's a fairly low risk application.
Can you give an example of that? Like in the health sector? Yeah.
So for example, in our case, we don't touch physicians or patients directly. Our system is internal to a company and it supports the company in understanding their customers' needs, the gaps that they have to fill in evidence in order for their customers to be able to adopt a manufacturer's products more effectively, which means that as an SME and our users are typically MD, PhDs. So when I say subject matter expert, they're a medical expert in an oncology or hematology or something of that specificity. So they can read what the AI is suggesting or producing and take a call on whether there is something on or off or edit it or give feedback to the system. So it's still hugely assistive in that it reduces time spent and effort by, you know, 90%, 80%, 81%, depending on the application, but it's not going to a patient or a physician unmonitored. And to that, that's a low risk application. Then you've got a medium risk application where there might be a place for an appeal, but the AI system might be determining an end outcome a little more directly. So a human being can appeal that decision, but normally we would think of it as a medium risk. And then you have high risk. So for example, credit approval or policing or you've got determining life insurance or insurance eligibility. These are all very high risk applications because the impact on the end consumer is extremely serious and it's unmitigated by a subject matter expert. Now, these systems can be very useful and are often very useful because it allows you to deliver speed in a space and an industry where speed matters. But it can also create a lot of barriers because systems are trained on data as is. So it represents our civilization as is with all of its imperfections, which means a lot of that will get translated into how a system is making decisions, quote unquote. And so we consider that a high risk application. So I think we have to weigh pros and cons and biases in these contexts of where it's being applied, what kind of decisions it's taking, what are the implications, what are the room for appeal or reconsideration, and so on and so forth. So that's one part of it.
Yeah, I really like that framing real quick too, is just like the low, medium, and high. And I think that's something we'll sort of, off the back of this, when we're putting out the episode, frame for our guests and just like really help them understand. Because I think there's all this conversation about the risks of AI and like and it's just all kind of bundled together. But the fact that you were able to like synthesize and like break it out into different areas and understand, okay, here's low, here's medium, here's high, and we don't even touch that level of risk, but here is the level of risk that we're playing at, I think is just really important in bringing people up to speed and educating them on the levels of risk within AI applications and health tech in particular. So thank you for that framing.
And of course, medical diagnosis can be decision support can be a low risk application. So from decision support to decision augmentation, which is, let's say financial investment, all the way to automation, which is just next best action. You're blindly following the machine and you can group your applications in these three buckets. That's one part of it. And then let's like call out bias. And I think bias is philosophically and otherwise a very interesting concept. And when we think about bias, first and foremost, bias is always in contrast to something, right? So you have to have a state of, we have to be able to define what is lack of bias in order to be able to identify bias. And I think what's interesting in healthcare is that healthcare does not operate, and actually no field operates without bias, even outside of the machine. So a physician, as well-educated, experienced as they might be, is always bringing their bias to the table when they're treating a patient. And a physician's bias towards a patient based on their previous experience, their own issues, their own concerns will impact treatment. So it's not like misdiagnosis is something that is coming to the fore only with AI. I think I read a few years ago that 82% of first diagnoses of a complex disease is often wrong. What? And that's why a second opinion is so material.
Wow.
So human error, whether it's from straight up error or bias, is ever present. Number two is in health, a lot of, in AI, we've tried to identify representation of bias. How do you know that there could be bias? So you think about things like race, age, demographic, gender, as sort of descriptors or variables that can indicate the presence of bias. At the same time, all of these are actually relevant to a patient's diagnosis. There are actually differences in particular diseases, like let's say multiple myeloma, which is more prevalent in Black men than it is in white men. So you do see certain racial segregation or gender, etc. So you need to be able to identify it without removing it. Because if you actually removed all mention of gender or age or demographic or diet, it will actually break the diagnosis itself. So when it again comes to healthcare, Sorcero's approach is to develop, we work a lot on the basis of ontologies, and everything we do is explainable in that we can explain to the end user how the system has been constructed and also be able to modify it. So if we want to highlight all mentions of gender so that we can engage with that concept later, we can do that. We have taken the approach of identifying possible incidences of bias so that we can then address them if required without removing it from the system. But I actually think that's a big part of it. The bigger issue is actually data itself. There is not data at a population health level uniformly within a country or across the globe. So there are countries in which we still don't record dates of birth and dates of death systematically, which means when you're thinking about, you know, population health metrics, they're really broken. So the thing I think about is without a standardization in data collection and historical data being so diverse and varied in different countries, how can you even design a system that is going to work at scale and help people understand potential health risks for a population if they don't even have basic data on that population that is at least a decade old or a decade long?
Yeah, it sounds like there's underlying data quality issues, you know, before you feed anything even into the machine, as it were. So how do you sort of clean that up first and then chuck it in there? That's interesting. And that's maybe a good
garbage start. In, garbage out is one of the most common things you're going to hear. And I cannot tell you how true that is, whether it's at small scale or at large scale.
That's great. Cool.
Yeah, but so important as a result that, the data that you collect is clean and therefore makes legible the biases that are already in the system, which were just sort of invisible before. I was so interested to kind of hear about your plain language summaries and how they make complex medical research accessible for everyone. Would you be able to tell us a bit about those and your sort of impetus to make them?
Absolutely. You know, most patients don't understand medicine, and that's normal. I often don't understand a lot of the technical terms or terminology that my physician is telling me. What's interesting is often physicians don't as well. The speed of drug discovery, development, new therapies, new modalities, new science is emerging. It is emerging very, very fast. And scientific content as a whole is growing at a 36% CAGR. Plain language summaries, and these are summaries of abstracts, of manuscripts, of posters, of clinical trial results, or even of marketing materials, is designed to make that content more accessible to patients, physicians, payers, and absolutely anyone who's receiving it. Now, what's interesting is generally plain language summaries are written by medical writers. So this is somebody with the expertise to understand the original content and then rewrite it for popular consumption or for mass consumption. Now, the issue is that when you kind of examine the quality or the readability in this case of most plain language summaries in market today, you find that it's only accessible by 2% of the population based purely on reading grade or reading ability. And, you know, there are lots of tools that will tell you what is the grade of a particular writing or the reading grade. Now, obviously, 2% isn't nearly enough to call it a plain language summary or a patient-lay summary, which is the other phrase for this. So what we do is we've developed an AI augmented workbench. So think of it as supporting the writer rather than replacing the writer. So we generate a first or a second draft for a writer to take to completion. And that end result of the AI workbench plus writer has been, and we ran studies on this that are available with both patients and physicians, are 600% more readable. And what's interesting is we didn't just measure readability, we measured tone. And the patients that read these found these summaries to be more empathetic. And I think that's the other important part is in a moment of diagnosis, when you're sitting in front of a physician or you're dealing with a healthcare provider or worker, you're not just looking for a clinical decision. You're also hoping for a certain amount of empathy and engagement in what you would call the bedside manner side of the house. And so Sorcero's plain language summary workbench can support all of these types of content more readably, more accessibly, personalize it to the different stakeholders who might be receiving the summary, as well as make it more empathetic to the patient.
one of the things that typically comes up is folks are worried about being replaced by AI, right? So that's a whole thing. And but also there's this dialogue of maybe it won't replace us, maybe it can augment the work that we do or help us do cooler, more interesting work. And I think that's like a really active, robust conversation. So we'd love to just understand how you think and maybe how you're doing this with Sorcero, how AI can complement the expertise of medical professionals rather than replace it. And any feedback that you've received from medical practitioners using Sorcero's tools and how it's developed the development of your products, their work. We'd love to dig into that and hear a bit more about that.
Sure. So one of our founding principles is this little symbolic formula which says human plus AI is greater than either alone. And that's remained true from the very beginning of the company and is becoming even truer with more applications we have and more customers and users we support. And this comes down to something very simple. Well, let me give you a really fun example that one of my co-founders, Walter, taught me a long time ago, which is it is easier for an AI to beat you at a game of Go than it is for an AI to go to a store and buy a game of Go. And maybe that captures what these systems are particularly good at vis-a-vis a human being and what they're frankly not. So as much as we would like an AI to literally do our laundry for us, and one can argue that there are now washing machines with certain AI configurations taking a call on the weight or the level of dirt in laundry, it cannot really pick up your clothes and put it in the laundry machine and do it for you.
And I think that's really interesting because I see a lot of stuff on social. It's like, I don't want AI to take my job. Like, I want it to do my laundry and do the chores around the house and stuff like that, rather than taking my job from me. So can we structure AI so that it can maybe, do some of those things, and then I have more time for art or more time for creative pursuits? I think that's a really interesting active conversation out there.
And I think with the advances we're seeing in robotics and robotic helpers, which is obviously, AI in the actual physical body, mm-hmm. we're going to hopefully see some of that around the house as well. We already have robot vacuums as a case in point. But that notwithstanding, I think what's important is the human brain, no matter how much time they have, cannot deal with the sheer volume of content in the world. If you just think about content generation and forget even the science of it, everyone's a content creator right now.
Guilty. We're a content marketing agency. So
we
think about that a lot because we're always when do we produce net new content versus maybe repurpose something versus reuse something and try to direct audiences there. So it's a big problem. And thank you for bringing it up and mentioning it. So
the sheer volume of content in good content, great content, relevant content, content that is interesting or content just purely material to your work. Mm. There is absolutely no way a human being can keep up with all of it, even if they spent 24 hours a day reading.
Right.
And in the world of cancer, for example, there are tens of thousands of papers that come out every month, maybe more. So it's not possible for even the most dedicated of physicians to both see patients and keep up with that.
Can I ask just about that? That's interesting when you bring up cancer, and obviously it's the thing we all want to beat, right? But potentially is the answer for, curing cancer and buried within all of those reports? Is that why the promise of AI is so exciting? Because AI can sort of synthesize all that faster than we can as humans. And maybe inside all those research reports and studies, the answer is in there. What do you think about that?
I don't think it's going to be the cure.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be, and it is often, finding connections and relationships between patient characteristics, treatments, mm-hmm. symptoms that you might not have noticed before. Mm-hmm. So certainly is, when our systems are deployed with a customer, it's sort of in three categories: speed, scale, cost, of course, maybe four then. There's speed of analysis. How much faster can I get through those 10,000 articles, hypothetically, than I would have been able to if I had access to an infinite number of people and an infinite amount of time? Scale, how much of it can I do? Can I do it with, the interaction of a particular kind of, let's say, HER2-negative breast cancer with certain dietary habits or age groups or demographics or other factors? And the third is cost. human beings are, and particularly in medicine, are not inexpensive. There are not masses of doctors in the way that you think, which means that the skills required for somebody to do it is not that many. So, for example, a lot of our users are MD PhDs. They are both physicians and have a PhD. They've probably spent over 20 years in universities. And the world at large, I think, only produces about 600 or under 1,000 of them a year. So if you think about how many people there is a prohibitive cost of finding these people. Hmm. And then even if you did, there aren't enough of them. And then, of course, is the unknown unknowns, which is really what we're talking about here. What can I discover in my data that I could not have previously foreseen? What can the data point me to that I do not know the question for? And it goes back a little bit to the Hitchhiker's Guide, right? Like, it's all about asking the right question. But sometimes you don't know that there is something in the data. And an AI system that has been taught to seek certain patterns or look for certain relationships can help surface that and help you make better decisions. So we definitely think about that as a very important part of this augmentation exercise.
Yeah, I remember writing something, I think early this year, about Limbic AI, which is essentially a chatbot using asking patients for symptoms in order to sort of refer them to mental health providers. It basically creates a detailed referral by discerning patterns in their replies to the chatbots about their symptoms. And then touching back on our conversation about biases, the use of this chatbot increased sort of referrals by 179% for non-binary people, 40% for Black users, and 39% for Asian users. And just really interesting how this chatbot, increased referrals for minority communities.
Oh, absolutely. There was a very interesting article. There are two points I'd love to make on this that I think is really relevant. One is that I was just reading an article in The Economist yesterday, which talked about the relationship, the literal relationship between mental health illnesses like anxiety and depression and autoimmune diseases. Well, they're finding that the chemicals that the lack of or too much of that actually trigger depression or trigger anxiety actually has a relationship with autoimmune diseases. So actually treating the disease or the physical symptoms with steroids and other drugs can actually lead to lessening of the depression and the anxiety. So it's not just mental health. And that is one of the things that AI can expose, is these relationships. And I want to say the correlations is a really important way to think about this.
Absolutely. And now, just to sort of close with a pivot about more of your founding journey. So you've previously founded 42 Strategies and are a founding member of Chief, a private network for women in positions of power. What has your experience been as a female leader in tech? And what advice do you have for other aspiring female tech leaders?
In one word, I think I would say that it's been interesting. I chose to start when we founded Sorcero, Walter and I initially, and then Richard joined us later. But when Walter and I founded Sorcero, we thought of it more as a future of work, learning approach to materials and content, and using AI to make new information more accessible to the adult workforce. So it was more of a horizontal play. And much of the core technology is still the same, or the approach to it is still the same, but the business problems we're solving have changed radically. And I think it's a very different experience founding something that is intended to be horizontal versus intending it to be vertical. And we are now a pure play vertical software company where we work at the intersection of life sciences, not healthcare, very precisely life sciences and commercialization of products and tech and AI. So I think horizontals are just interesting. I think it's interesting to be a female founder anywhere, because there is always, you're going to deal with all sorts of interesting experience, from bias to what I like to call the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Love that quote.
But then also in life sciences, there is a lot of diverse people and women in pharma. So what I'm finding more and more, the deeper we go into pharma, is how many incredible women and diverse people there are at all levels. And that's been really fantastic. So not only am I finding more diversity on the startup side of the house, but also on the customer side of the house. And that diversity has been really, really delightful.
Mm. Yeah, that resonates in two ways. One, as a growth strategy agency, like we've definitely experienced like the vertical versus horizontal piece, and we've decided to go, you know, vertical in terms of our sector expertise. So like tech for good, health tech, fintech is another one we work in, ed tech, but also to kind of go horizontal in terms of the services that we provide. So just realizing that our clients, like they want a little bit of web, they want a little bit of branding, they want content and SEO, then they ask us for digital PR, and we're like, you know, we kind of do want to be a one-stop shop for growth for these amazing companies, like, you know, started by founders like yourself, who are doing such cool things. And we get to obviously interview them and talk to them and help them scale their products and stuff. So really, really appreciate that. And the other piece is diversity. Like you go to our team page, you won't see a more diverse team that's producing marketing and growth strategy content than most London agencies. So we've like really hung our hat on the importance of diversity in terms of making better teams that produce better work for, you know, for our clients. So just really appreciate that you've called out the diversity in life sciences in particular. That's very, because like I can't think of more challenging, you know, important issues to solve for than what's happening right now in life sciences and you know, biotech and health tech to some extent. So it's good to hear that there's that diversity there answering those questions.
Mm, and while your phrase about the soft bigotry of low expectations, which you very much should trademark, while that resonates with me.
Oh, it's not my quote.
It's from George W. Bush, by the way.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It is. I know.
Well, I'll be using it a lot and I'll credit you. While that resonates with me a lot, one thing that doesn't is the idea that you have founded your company with your partner. That sounds like hell. What advice would you give to other co-founder couples?
You know, it's interesting you bring that up. My partner, and I'm very lucky in that, has been an entrepreneur and an investor for the last 19 years and has built and scaled companies into hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue and sold them and done it in data science and regulated industries and so forth. It's been brilliant. And I would credit that partnership is a big reason why we have succeeded and we continue to grow. At the end of the day, you know, when you have co-founders, they're no different from being in a partnership. You spend an absurd amount of time together. You encounter unarticulatable problems, things that you couldn't have dreamed of. And for us, I think one of the defining things was, first and foremost, I had to recruit Richard pretty hard. I was competing with people with vastly more money than I had at that time. So Richard's our third co-founder, who joined a few years after we started the company. So he joined 3 years later. But I had to recruit him into the company. But soon after we did, the pandemic hit. And one of the important things to understand is how much in-person time it takes to build something like that. And we had the privilege of being in the same house and being monomaniacally focused on a single goal. I think that's the other important thing to remember. As entrepreneurs, we have to be monomaniacally focused on our startup for many, many, many more years than I thought I would. And the pivoting, the journey, the markets is constantly changing. So first and foremost, if you are an entrepreneur with a family, you're going to need a very, very supportive family, because you're going to kind of be absent and kind of awful for a lot of the time.
Or just recruit your partner to join you so that it's not an issue.
Or you do that and you resolve any potential conflicts by having a monomaniacal focus. Yeah. But I think that I do want to say that Richard and my relationship, both at work at home, are unique in that we are very focused on doing things in the world and would support each other no matter what industry. But we also have very complementary skills in that my strengths and Richard's are different. So if he was not my life partner, I can still see him as a part of Sorcero. And I think that's maybe the more important thing to highlight, is what the raw skills and experience that he brings to the table that I did not start Sorcero with.
Well, that's great. I think that's a great, I mean, thank you for like upending the conventional wisdom that like working with your partner is like, you know, terrible or frustrating or something like that.
Some of the greatest companies in the world are founded by married couples. And in fact, all businesses were family businesses to begin with. So, you know, I know we talk about this at work, but actually that is the most traditional format.
Yeah, no, and it resonates with me too. I mean, I grew up, I had two dads growing up, and both my dads, they were started small businesses, and I got to see them navigating those businesses together. And it was fascinating. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot as a kid, like watching them, you know, do that. And I think it's led me to sort of found my own business. And I hear you. I moved to London and started my company with my co-founder, Will. And, you know, it was the middle of the pandemic as well. So we had nothing but time to kind of hunker down. And eventually we had like a coach who was kind of like our couples therapist, you know, it was like helping us work through things and stuff like that. And now he's transitioned out of the business, but I feel like we really went through that period of we were just monomaniacal about getting things started. And here we are today. We've got, you know, a million-pound agency with, you know, 10 staff, and, you know, we're doing exciting things. So one quick further question to close. Obviously, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you about your growth strategy for Sorcero. That's what we do. We're a growth strategy agency. You've helped 23% of top global pharmaceutical companies process vast amounts of medical data with unparalleled speed and accuracy. You've delivered over 1 million AI-generated summaries of complex medical publications, and excuse me if those numbers aren't updated, but that's incredibly impressive. Give us like one or two hints about what is coming in your growth strategy. How will you continue to grow Sorcero from this amazing foundation?
So the truth is, in spite of the size of those numbers, it's super small. It's very much the beginning, and every single day that I go to work, I realize how much we are just scratching the surface. So in terms of growth, we think about it in three or maybe four ways. One is continuing to serve our existing customers and making sure that more and more of their team and more of their business problems are supported using the Sorcero platform. Number two is, you know, we have four products built on the platform at the moment and more to come, at least three, if not four more to come in the years. And we hope that that full stack is going to get adopted to support adjacent and cross-functional teams within pharma, because it is a cross-functional team that supports the commercialization of a product. The third is we want to see more geographical expansion, making sure that teams across the globe that, you know, that work up to the same brand are able to standardize how they share data and measure their impact. And maybe the fourth is, what are certain areas? So we are therapeutic area agnostic, so it doesn't really matter what the, you know, what kind of disease the drug treats, but we're particularly interested in supporting more oncology and rare diseases where we're seeing incredible innovation. And there's also 1,100 phase three compounds sitting with the FDA. A vast majority, and a good number of them are going to get approved over the next 5 years. And we'd love to support those incredible companies as they take these products to market and help make sure it reaches the right patient in time.
That's a really incredible stat about the phase three compounds. And yeah, we'll be sure to share that with our audience. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. We're out of time today, but this has been a fantastic conversation with Dipanita Das, the co-founder and CEO of Sorcero. We're so grateful for your time today. Thank you for the amazing work that you're doing in the life sciences space.
Thank you very much.
I assume if folks want to find out more, they can go to Sorcero.com. Would that be a good place to find you and get connected?
Absolutely. The website's the perfect place. Or also you can drop us a message on LinkedIn.
Sounds good. And that's Sorcero.com. And we'll put that in the episode description. But Dee, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it. And we wish you the best with your growth journey.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Cool. And thanks, everyone. This has been another great episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Little Humans. Very happy to welcome Maya, our new guest co-host, to the show today. And please, as always, give us a 5-star rating. Please review and share with your friends this great episode. Thanks, everyone.